I will put money on it. I've not had to reply to you.
Just get some.
I can
be thinking
The last speaker of this session is Mark Harmer from the place named Fish, and he will tell us something about spin interference and the Roche for Hamiltonian.
Thank you very much for safety organizers. Thank you very much for having me here and letting me come to this lovely place and meet all these distinguished researchers who are just names before I came here, names on papers. So it's been very nice and I've enjoyed speaking to you, people I have not spoken to. After it speaks for itself, I'll begin just by giving you a quick summary of what I'm talking about. Okay, this is a, compared to the other stuff we've had here, a very simple talk just about looking at Rashbach Hamiltonians on quantum graphs and using them in applications of design of nanoelectronic devices. So there's some overlap with the talk of Pankashkin on Rashbach Hamiltonians, but only in the most superficial sense. And in fact, there's a talk of our chairperson, in terms of actually, if you can use spin to transmit information down wires, I mean, that's sort of a basic assumption in this whole thing. But anyway, let me get on with it. First of all, I'll begin.
Is your microphone on?
No, I don't.
There's no microphone.
I don't have a microphone, but hopefully I'm going to get one just now. I have a bit of a blocked nose as well, which I'm sure makes it even worse. anyway, hopefully I'll have a microphone just now. I'll begin with a short discussion of the Rashbach effect and then its sort of application in one-dimensional quantum graphs. In particular, the Rashbach effect on ring structures. I'll discuss this at some length and describe the spectrum and eigenfunctions and Green's functions for this type of system. Then I'm afraid I'm going to have to speak about boundary conditions again. I'll be looking at attaching my Rashbach ring to some sort of non-compact graph and N-terminal non-compact system, and describe the scattering matrix in some detail again for that. In principle, when you've got the scattering matrix, you pretty much know everything about the system, but in practice, if you want to do something like design some sort of nanoelectronic device, you want some more qualitative insight into the system. So I'll be speaking a little bit about symmetries of these systems, and in order to do that, I'll introduce the Bronsky and talk a bit about symmetries, and then
okay. We'll see that there's certain pretty obvious class of systems which lend themselves to being spin filters, and then I will basically do all this stuff on that system and give you some hopefully nice plots of the sort of polarization coming out of such an object and the flux or conductance. I'm not sure what the proper term is of these objects. One of the motivations of studying spin on graphs is really to have a look at multi-particle spin states on graphs, on, I should say, metric graphs. I'm not looking at discrete graphs, obviously. So I will, time permitting, just spend a little while talking about some work I've done on, or some ideas I've had on multi-particle spin quantum graphs. Oh, it's quite a mouthful. Okay. So let me just say some words of introduction. First of all, I've been expecting someone to sort of address this throughout the workshop, but I suppose people have done it implicitly. I mean, first of all, what justification do we have for speaking about? Actually, this was the topic I think of the last talk. What justification do we have for speaking about quantum graphs instead of quantum waveguides? And I mean, this is a far from open problem, and I know that Pavlov and Olaf Post, and as I say, the last speaker, Professor Solomyak, have investigated this in some detail. But anyway, granted that we can use quantum graphs as a model of quantum waveguides, one of the great advantages of such object is at least the finite quantum graph, perhaps with
I'm not trying to define what I mean by finite, but a finite quantum graph are in some sense completely solvable, so we can then go ahead and calculate all scattering coefficients for such objects, and this has the advantage of allowing us to make qualitative statements about whether such an object would be good to use as, say, a spin filter or not. I mean, they should always be taken with some caution, because obviously we can't really make absolute quantitative statements about how such an object would behave, but we can at least say, well, if you look at this parameter regime, you can expect to have a reasonable spin filter, and this is what I'll be speaking about today. Okay. That was... Okay. I should mention some of previous work in this area. Spintronics is pretty popular. I think pretty much all the physics papers that I've seen in this area mention the paper by Dutta and Das, not the same Dutta, who proposed a way of modulating current using the spin of electrons, a so-called spin field effect transistor. I'm not a physicist, and I don't think that this device has been realized, or I don't, as far as I know. Anyway, I don't know. Maybe some physicists could set me right on that. But there are other, I mean, as far as I know, spin is used quite a lot, and the so-called spintronics and the giant, giant magnetoresistance, which I believe is actually used in current technology. Getting a little closer to home, the Rashba effect is quite a popular way of implementing a spin interaction on quantum graphs, as Pankrashkin showed. I'll mention a few other authors. Actually, all of these people, I think, all of these are looking at spin filtering using the Rashba effect to some extent. And the Rashba effect has the obvious advantage is that it's sort of, I believe it's sort of natural and sort of easy to implement in a semiconductor device. And as I say, I'm not a physicist, but I believe this is why it's so popular. The paper of, let me just mention a few of these. Nitta et al. Considered a two-terminal device, which they believed they could use to modulate current similar to Dutta and Das device. I think for such a device, at least with the Rashba effect, you can show that spin filtering is not possible at all. Streeter and Schieber considered something a little more complicated, and weren't entirely sure what it was, but they had the Rashba effect and the magnetic field and used sort of a 2D device to implement spin filtering, as far as I know. Also, I won't try and pronounce that name, but they considered a device consisting of two wires, and essentially it was also two-dimensional because there was a two-dimensional region between the wires with the Rashba effect on it, and using this Rashba effect they could selectively allow current to flow from one wire to the other, thereby implementing spin filtering. Kiselev and Kim is actually quite close to what we're looking at here. They consider three-terminal devices with the Rashba effect, and in some sense we consider very similar devices, although we do them on quantum graphs, which, as I say, allow us to get much more explicit data on such devices. So, okay. Well, the rest is pretty self-explanatory. We're looking at electrons on graphs of the Rashba effect, basically. That's what the rest says. Okay, so let me just start with my introduction of the Rashba effect. So the Rashba spin orbit Hamiltonian only occurs, I'm told, when you have structural inversion asymmetry, which I don't know what exactly that is, but if you do, then you have this sort of Hamiltonian appearing, where, of course, sigma is a vector of Pauli spin matrices, and this is a momentum vector, and n is the Rashba effect is essentially happens in two-dimensional electron gases, and n is a normal vector to the two-dimensional gas. In our case, the normal is always going to be the z vector, so we're always working in the xy plane. And just to set notation, these are the Pauli spin matrices. I've already said that ID will be the 2x2 unit matrix, and alpha is just the Rashbaugh coupling, so the strength of the Rashbaugh effect. I'm going to want to look at this effect in a ring. So let me write this Hamiltonian in polar coordinates. I get something like this, where these are sigma r and sigma theta, and then basically. So the next step, I have to sort of wave my hands. You can find the details in some physics papers, but you can convert this essentially two-dimensional Rashbaugh Hamiltonian. You basically get rid of this radial dependence. Although this term will actually still survive. The justification for that is probably a little complicated. So what I do is I look at a parabolic confining potential on my ring, and then look at the sort of the ground states of that, and then take the as I understand it, I take the full Hamiltonian and take the diagonal matrix element of that full Hamiltonian with respect to the ground state, and then I basically get something that's R independent, and it turns out to be this thing over here, where D naught is going to be a sort of a free term plus a Rashbaugh term over here. And if you square it out, you'll see, as I said, that you know this term here will still survive. But anyway, that's so important. Okay. Okay, so now what I'm going to want to do is just discuss the spectrum of this object and the eigenfunctions and Green's function. To do that, I solve the eigen equation. This is not actually an eigenfunction because it's not continuous, but it's a solution of this equation. And it's probably the basic thing I learned from this whole investigation was to write everything using Pauli spin matrices. So all of my solutions, in particular, this solution consists of both spin states written together as one function. So everything here is a 2x2 matrix. Another thing I should point out is that this angle phi is obviously just given by the Rashbaugh coupling alpha, and it'll appear again just now. Okay, so there's my solutions of the eigen equation. The actual eigenvectors, the eigenvectors are given by these things over here. The eigenvalues are the zeros of this thing over here, which just gives me continuity. And it's sort of natural for me to just take, forget the plus minus, and just take n as an integer. That's going to give me all the eigenvalues, as you can see here. Just plus minus just drops away when I'm considering integers. But it's, for our purposes, it's much more convenient to write the eigenvalues as two series with, I've taken lambda minus as being at the sort of the ground state, and then the plus minus is sort of all of the rest. Okay, so what does the spectrum look like? Well, it's perhaps not so surprising that with the Rashbaugh Hamiltonian, you always get multiplicity 2. In the sort of normal spin state, you're going to get multiplicity 4. The Rashbaugh Hamiltonian splits that, and I get multiplicity 2. So each eigenvector, lambda plus minus, is spanned by each eigenvalue is spanned by, the eigenspace is spanned by these two eigenvectors. And there's a sort of a splitting in energy that happens. Where is it gone? Okay. So you can see, for instance, I'll speak of this as the spin-up state and the spin-down state. I'll justify that just now. You can see, for instance, that with the spin-up state, the left-going and the right-going spin-up state eigenvectors have got different energy because the left-going here corresponds to lambda plus n and the right-going corresponds to lambda minus n, so there's a splitting in energy between left and right-going. Okay, so what are these spin eigenstates look like? Well, this value phi here, as I say, is just the tan of that is just the Rashba coefficient, and the spin eigenstates are, you can think of them as being perturbed off being up and down spin states just by this angle phi, and they're so the azimuth sort of, what is it? Azimuth of an angle is phi, and the angle on the xy plane will be theta. So what I mean by that is that these spin up, spin down states point towards the center of the circle. So I'm just illustrating that the spin states are somehow sensitive to the curvature of the one dimensional wire that they're on. Another thing I want to point out, it'll appear later, is that when this term over here, when this term in brackets is an integer, then you actually get this twofold degeneracy raises to a fourfold degeneracy. So these eigenvalues sort of line up. So when this thing is an integer, then lambda minus of n equals lambda plus of n plus m. And we'll observe some strange behavior of the filter later at those particular strengths of the spin orbit coupling. Okay, so the next thing I want to do is write an explicit expression for the Green's function, which is just the kernel of the resolvent. It's just the solution of this nasty system over here. And that can be written in a nice compact form, again using the fact that using this expression here for the eigensolutions in terms of Pauli spin matrices. So, okay, it's not going to... Sorry, just give me a... What the hell? Okay. So we get this... Okay, so this is the expression that I'm going to use in the rest here. Okay. So having discussed the ring at some length, I'm now going to attach it to a few semi-infinite wires, n semi-infinite wires. So I'm going to have a Rashba effect, as I say, on the ring. They'll just have the free Hamiltonian on the wires. You can't really have a Rashba effect on the wires because, well, you can, but it doesn't make sense. Okay. So as I say, we have the free Hamiltonian on the wires, just the second derivative operator, and I'll write the spin states in terms of a sort of a Pauli spin matrix, just the identity matrix. And I should mention that the orientation of these semi-infinite wires is obviously completely dependent on how you embed them in the xy plane. So the when you speak about making spin measurements on these wires along the x or y axes, you've just got to show some small caution, but nothing too serious. Okay, the boundary conditions at the connections. First of all, I'll assume that no two wires are attached at the same point. It's just a technical restriction, and so if I assume all my derivatives are outward going and I number the edges so that phi 2 and phi 3 are on the ring and phi 1 is on the infinite wire, I'm going to have these sort of boundary conditions. So in particular, the wave function will be assumed to be continuous on the ring, and there'll be some coefficient beta of sort of coupling between the wire and the ring. And I think what I want to point out here is that there's basically I'm modeling each of these junctions as T junctions. What I mean by that is that there's a symmetry between the phi 2 and phi 3 are basically on the same footing, and phi 1 is on a different footing. And in fact, this is perhaps a little bit of an aside, but these boundary conditions, if I take these boundary conditions and just consider the vertex in isolation, then the scattering matrix that I get for this is actually a standard scattering matrix for the T junction is considered in a lot of physics papers. In particular, there's a book by yet another Dutta who considers this problem and proposes a scattering matrix which is exactly the one you get from these boundary conditions. So there's another thing I want to mention, which is that in these boundary conditions you'll see that there's no mention of any magnetic term in the derivatives, which is what you'd normally expect for boundary conditions with a magnetic field. That's not to say that these aren't self-adjoint. These are still self-adjoint boundary conditions. The point is, because I'm assuming continuity on the ring, there's no need to include any magnetic term in the boundary conditions. So first point is that these boundary conditions are self-adjoint. As I said, beta is some sort of strength of coupling between the wire and the ring. And I'll assume that beta is the same for each component of the spinner, so the boundary conditions are spin independent. And it may be different at each vertex of the graph. Okay. So in fact, my derivation of the sort of relevant properties, the polarization and that sort of thing, will be for arbitrary beta, but the when it comes to putting the stuff into computer, which is what I'll do at the end, I'm just going to put beta equals 1 because it's just another sort of parameter to fiddle with. If you want to try a different beta, you can always go back to the program and re-enter it. It's not a big deal.
Is beta allowed to be complex or is it real?
No, beta is real. I'm looking at self-adjoint boundary conditions. Yeah. Okay. So I mentioned that last point already. Okay, so this is the standard ansatz for the scattering matrix. I've got some matrix, Sij. The diagonal entries are going to be the reflection coefficients, and Sij is going to be the transmission coefficient from the jth edge to the ith edge. I've swapped perhaps the ordering from what it usually is because it's sort of a hangover from when I considered these as matrices, because anyway, don't worry. Because the differential operator always has to act on the left when you're in a matrix situation. Anyway, and again, let me just say that these scattered waves and the scattering matrix, these coefficients are all should be considered as 2x2 matrices, sort of Pauli spin matrices. Okay. Okay, so because of my choice of boundary conditions, namely that the wave function is continuous on the ring, I can choose this ansatz for the scattered waves. So I take my Green's function and evaluate one of the arguments at each of the points on the ring where the wires are attached, and I get a vector of values, and then there's going to be some matrix here which will give me my scattered waves on the ring, okay? And then on the Okay, so that's what the scattered wave looks like on the ring, on the wires. I've already told you what it looks like. And from that form, we can write out the value of the scattered waves at all of the points of attachment and the derivative at all the points of attachment. And likewise, defining a matrix in terms of the Green's function, I can it's just a tautology that the scattered wave on the ring at each of the points of attachment is just given by this sum over here. And from the fact that the jump and the derivative of the Green's function is unity, the derivative, the jump and the derivative of the scattered waves is just going to be given by my matrix Aij. So what I've got here is I've got two equations, because this thing is equal to this thing, and this thing is equal to this thing, up to some constant beta, which is just my coupling between the wire and the rings. So there's a beta there's a beta in here somewhere, which I haven't written down. So I take these two equations and I eliminate the matrix A, and that gives me the standard form for the scattering matrix, which looks like this. So this beta is just going to be a diagonal matrix of coupling constants at each of the wires. G is the matrix from the Green's function. And so maybe the strange thing for me, this is quite a sort of a familiar answer. It's in the physics literature for the scattering matrix. I don't think it's ever used in quite this context, but anyway, perhaps the strange thing for me is that this only works for this relationship between the scattering matrix and the Green's function is only going to work for a very restricted class of boundary conditions. In particular, you need at least that the wave function is continuous on the ring, otherwise this doesn't make sense, because the Green function is continuous on the ring. In fact, I'm not entirely sure that those boundary conditions might even be the most general in which this ansatz works. But that's an aside. Okay, so we know a lot about the scattering matrix. We can write it down. It's actually it's a fairly nasty matrix. It's an n-by-n matrix where all of the coefficients are 2x2 non-commuting matrices. And we'll see that a little bit later. That can be quite nasty. But so in principle, we know everything about the system. But in practice, we want to tease out some more of the qualitative features of it. And we'll do that so that we can say whether it'll make a good spin filter. And we'll do that by looking at some of the symmetries. In order to do this, we have a look at basically the Vronskian on the graph. So at this point, I'm going to draw something. It's a really simple idea, but it's used occasionally. So I've got some graph. And I consider a closed curve here on the graph and take the points of intersection of my graph with the closed curve. And then I look at this quadratic form, F and G, and evaluated at all of the points of intersection and sum over those points of intersection. I call that the Vronskian. And it's, first of all, it's very easy to see that if F and G are just formal solutions of the of the eigenvalue equation for the same value of K, that first of all, this locally it makes sense. Okay, what I mean by that is if I move this line here to another point, I'll still get the same value for the Vronskian. If I start moving it across a vertex, then all sorts of bad things can happen. But if I furthermore assume that these functions are not just locally eigenfunctions, but are eigenfunctions which satisfy my self-adjoint boundary conditions, then this thing works even if I move across vertices, and in fact, it'll be zero. Okay. The Vronskian, the sum will be zero. That's really simple to see. I mean, you can see it by just sort of contracting it to a point, it'll be zero. Okay, so that's a nice way of calculating symmetries. For instance, if I just look at, or I should say, it's a nice way of finding symmetries of the scattering matrix if I know symmetries of the Hamiltonian. For instance, if I just take the Vronskian of two scattered waves, by the way, sorry, I didn't define what this D is. So D here is just, remember I defined the Hamiltonian as on the ring I defined it as D naught squared plus some constant, and on the wires I defined it as DI squared, where DI is just the derivative. So D is just going to be D naught or DI depending on where this intersection takes place. And you can generalize that to more general sort of Hamiltonians. Okay. So getting back here, if I just take two scattered waves and look at the Vronskian, as I've told you, this is equal to zero. I'm evaluating just on, now my point at which I'm evaluating is just going to be an arc encircling all the whole compact part of the graph like this. Okay, so I'm just summing over all the semi-infinite wires. Then these are just, this just follows from the ansatz. And calculating the sum, I see that in order for this to be zero, I need that the scattering matrix is unitary. And once again, I should probably just mention that this Vronskian is, like everything else, a 2x2 matrix value object. Okay. So let's look at, there are a few obvious symmetries that we can put in here, so we can sort of put in time reversal, and there are a few other symmetries as well. Let's assume that our graph has a reflection symmetry across the y-axis, for instance. So if that's true, then when I say I mean the graph and the boundary conditions and the Hamiltonian have a reflection symmetry, then it's obvious, it's pretty easy to see that the Hamiltonian will commute with this object over here. And so if I've got a scattered wave and I apply this object to the scattered wave, I'll get another maybe a linear combination of scattered waves, and I take the Vronskian of this and any other scattered wave, and I'm going to get some mess over here. And the fact that this mess has to equal zero means that the scattering matrix must equal, first of all, I apply R to the scattering matrix, which just means that I swap indices which correspond to a Y to minus Y flip, and I multiply by sigma Y. Sigma Y is now a block diagonal with sigma Y's on the diagonal. Okay. So this is just one of many symmetries. There are others. I mean, I believe this is called time reversal. This one, I'm not entirely sure what the physical motivation of this is, but if you apply it, I've checked it commutes with the Hamiltonian, and you can conceivably get other symmetries from it, but I'm not going to use anything like that. So okay. So using that, we'll study actually a specialization of our original class of graphs. So let's just look at a graph with just three terminals, and we'll assume it's got it's the reflection in the x-axis symmetry, and okay, then okay. So as I said to you, the components of the scattering matrix should be considered as 2x2 matrices. So I'm going to decompose this in terms of the Pauli spin matrices. So I've got this term here should have an ID in front of it. So it's actually some scalar multiplied by the identity matrix. And then I'll decompose with the other Pauli spin matrices. And then it's not too difficult to see that I'll call it the flux. Some people call it conductance and all sorts of other things. The flux from the jth terminal to the ith terminal is just this thing over here, which just says I'm just taking the square norms of all the I mean, this is just turns out to be the same as all the square norms of the 2x2 matrix, which is Sij. And the polarization from the jth terminal to the rth terminal in the alpha axis, so this is just the sort of expectation of spin. If you measured the spin on the alpha axis, what sort of expectation do you have? And it comes out to this thing over here. So, for instance, if alpha is the z-axis and everything is... Oh, sorry, no, that's not a good way to describe it because these are all written in some funny notation. Okay. Anyway, it comes out to that. Okay, so if I have my symmetry, I'll call it calligraphic R symmetry, that means that the scattering matrix satisfies this, which in terms of the components that I gave you earlier means that it satisfies this equation, where, as I say, R just permutes indices according to when I have reflection to the z-axis. Then we see that what this means is that the... Okay, let me draw you a picture. I'm not sure that this particular result can't be derived in some easier... Well, this is fairly easy when you've done it, but maybe you won't agree with me, but I'm not sure what I'm going to tell you can't be derived in an easier way, but still it's a useful way of looking at things, perhaps when they get a little more complicated. So this thing over here is the polarization measured when you go from the first terminal to the second. So this is terminal 1, this is terminal 2, this is terminal 3, this is what I had in the previous picture. So this is the polarization in the x-axis. So if I have some undefined sort of spin state coming down here, then the polarization in the x direction that I measure over here will be the opposite of the polarization in the x direction that I measure down in 3. It'll be, if I measure the polarization in the y direction, it'll be the same on those two edges. And if I measure the polarization in the z direction, which is the one I sort of really want to do because geometrically it makes more, probably to me at least it makes the most sense, the polarization that I measure over here will be opposite of the polarization I measure over there. So if your system has this sort of symmetry, it looks like it's a good candidate for spin filtering is what I'm trying to say. And so that's what we're going to do. We're going to consider this 3x3 object and calculate the scattering matrix. So I just want to say a few words about actually doing this calculation. It's been a great computational help for me in all the previous slides to use these Pauli spin matrices everywhere, but now when I get to the point of calculating the scattering matrix, it's sort of nasty because I've got a 3x3 matrix, but each of these matrix coefficients is a 2x2 matrix, and they don't necessarily commute, so I have some difficulty when I want to calculate determinants and all that sort of business. So in fact, with a little bit of work, you can write the S matrix, you can take off a conjugation by a unitary, and it comes out to this form. So this is just, I'm just applying the expression for the scattering matrix, which I had earlier, and an expression for the Green's function, which I had earlier. In fact, this term over here is sort of straight from the expression for the Green's function. Now, these matrices are nice because they do commute. All the coefficients commute there because the only Pauli spin matrix that's appearing is sigma z. So I can basically do this on Maple, which is what I do. And then I can worry about U and U star later. And with a little bit of work, I mean, it's not that easy. First of all, it's a fortunate happiness that the determinant of those matrices that I had on the previous slide is a complex scalar, so everything comes out quite nice. This nasty matrix U, which doesn't commute with everything because it has more than sigma z in it, it has the other Pauli spin matrices as well. This other matrix U, with a little bit of work, you can show that it does nothing to the flux at all, and it just introduces a multiplicative term, sigma cos phi, so just depending on the strength of the Rushbaugh coefficient over there. I mean it's actually a reasonably tedious, but in this nice case it's a doable computation. Okay, so with a little more work, these... another thing perhaps that no one has stood up and complained about is that these Zs here are actually all 2x2 matrices, because Z is a Pauli spin matrix, whereas this thing on the left is a scalar. But it turns out, again, this all makes sense. You know, it involves a bit of algebra, but I can assure you it makes sense. So anyway, getting rid of those Zs and writing them in terms of causes and signs and all that sort of business... Again, you need maple, and you can show that you get this and this for the... this is the measured expectation of spin, or the polarization, and this is the flux. The only thing that I had to do, actually, was I had to manually remove a term of cos kappa plus minus pi from all those expressions. I mean, I sort of did it by hand, and so I was getting an extra cos plus minus pi, and then I just... stuck it into maple. I just said divide everything through by these, and it worked. And I mean, these represent the eigenvalues on the ring. If you remember correctly, the eigenvalues on the ring are the zeros of these functions. So this is just the sort of eigenvalues on the ring appearing. You need to get rid of them, otherwise you're going to get nasty numerical singularities appearing. Anyway, so what do these R, X, and Y's look like? Well, X is this, Y is this. You've got to square these, so you're going to get a pretty big expression. Q looks like this, and R looks like that. And there's no beta anywhere because I've just put beta equals 1, otherwise it just looks nasty. Okay, so the first thing... you say, well, that's a big mess, I mean... Do you even know if it's right? Well, I mean, I did everything fairly carefully in about 3 times, so I'm pretty sure it's right. One of the first things you notice from this expression is that if kappa plus and kappa minus differ by an integer, which is exactly the case, if you remember in those early slides, corresponding to when the degeneracy of the eigenvalues goes from 2 to 4. So... in that case where you have degenerate eigenvalues, then all of these terms cancel each other. This term and this term, this term and this term, they all cancel up. And that means that Q equals zero, which means that if Q equals zero, that means that the polarization, which is proportional to Q equals zero. So when you have that degeneracy appearing, first of all, you get transmission, but there's no polarization of flux. And... which is what this slide tells you. Now, I'm not a physicist, but I asked a physicist why this happens, and I was told that because there's a sort of effective flux quanta through the ring and the integral number of effective flux quanta, but it didn't really make any sense to me. I mean, I could see how that could affect the overall flux through the ring, but not the polarization, which is the difference between flux in the up direction and flux in the down direction. So I've concocted an explanation which to me sort of also is hopefully proof that I haven't made any major mistakes, which is basically in terms of gauge transformations on the ring. If you do a gauge transformation, then the Hamiltonian on the ring just becomes a free Hamiltonian with some energy shift, and we see that when all the spin interaction is going to be concentrated on the boundary conditions, and so we see that when we have this value of the Rashba Hamiltonian, we have an integer multiple, then the boundary conditions, these boundary conditions which give a spin interaction, they become spin independent. So basically, if you have spin up going through the system, it'll just say stay spin up the whole way through, so there's no possibility of any spin polarization, because and in fact a similar argument shows that not the polarization but the flux, which the flux is obviously not going to be zero, but it turns out the flux using a similar argument is, you know, almost periodic in the Rashba coefficient. This is a so-called, let me get the... Yeah. The Aharonov-Bohm oscillation in the Rushbar effect. Okay, so I've included some plots of the conductance and the... So T is the total conductance from the first to the second terminal, and P is the polarized... flux. T is the flux from the first to the second terminal, and P is the polarized flux from the first to the second terminal in the z-axis. And I've already illustrated that the polarized flux from the first to the third terminal is going to be opposite of whatever it is the first to the second. So this this device will act like a filter. It'll hopefully it'll put all the sort of spin up electrons into one terminal and spin down electrons into the other terminal. As long as if these two curves almost or if these two curves touch, then we'll get perfect polarized flux. But we'll see that actually doesn't ever happen, but it gets pretty close. I've stuck the Rashbar coefficient at just 0.8. It doesn't really... The only thing I observed in terms of the Rashbar coefficient is that the zero in the polarization, which I mentioned earlier. So this is pretty much halfway between two zeros. So it's the best looking plots, you could say. I've plotted the eigenvalues on the ring with little squares and triangles. So they come in pairs. They'll both be, the first pair will be lambda plus 1 and lambda minus 1, with this one will always be to the left of that one because this one is always less than that one, if you remember the formula. And the ground state will be off the left of the plot because it always happens to be, it's always a negative ground state. Okay. I think that's all. Ah, okay, so pretty much running out of time, but the first plot is this angle psi is the angle between the two terminals. I'll look at it when psi is equal to pi over 2, and we see that polarization is maximum at odd and zero, pretty close to zero, at even lambda plus minuses. And we'll see for other values of this angle, we're going to get a sort of periodic behavior, which I have no idea what it comes from, and if anyone would like to tell me why it happens, I'd be very grateful. So we get a sort of periodic behavior, and the periodicity is related to this denominator, which is interesting. And we get zeros at certain values, but let's not worry about that. Okay, and it looks like this one, I mean, it's sort of obvious, really, but it looks like this one is the best candidate for a spin filter. Okay, so okay, I mean this is when the angle is pi over 2, and Kisilev and Kim consider a device that's quite similar to this, but I mean they look at numerics, so it's quite difficult for them to sort of generalize, but they suggest this is a good point for spin filtering, but from there I have a problem with that because you have a very steep change of sign just at that point, so it probably isn't that great for spin filtering. But anyway, you can see all the periodicity which I've been mentioning. This is pi over 3 and 2 pi over 3, which looks like the best sort of spin filter to me. Okay, anyway, there's all that. Okay, so I might just finish there, but before I do, I just want to mention that this the main body of this talk actually appears as a paper in JPA from last year. It's volume 39, 4329, article 14329. Okay, so it's JPA, volume 39, 2006. Okay, from last year. And yeah, I mean, I can mention more, but maybe I've run out of time.
Okay.
Yeah.
You told that the eigen functions mm-hmm. eigen spaces on the ring without attached ones mm-hmm. are twofold degenerate.
Mm-hmm.
But when you attach the semi-infinite ones, this twofold degeneracy probably disappears, but mm-hmm. fourfold remains somehow. Is it true or not? Because if you had twofold degeneracy inherited, then probably you can't say that polarization is non-zero.
I'm not sure that there are any embedded eigenvalues, to be honest. Because
so the degeneracy is not inherited by the resonances, probably.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know what you mean by degeneracy of resonances. That's the only problem.
Okay, maybe you can continue that. Are there any mm-hmm. other questions? I see none. So let's thank the speaker again. Mm-hmm.